Good evening and welcome to another segment of Center Stage.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to another segment of Center Stage. This is Terry Hines, your host. So glad to be with you tonight. Happy Friday, or TGIF, to everyone tonight. Listen, we're going to do a rebroadcast tonight. One of the hottest and the most popular shows that we did on Blog Talk Radio was a show that we did about Casey Anthony, Leonard Padella, which was the bounty hunter that actually posted the bond for Casey Anthony, was one of our guests, as well as Dr. Zoe Spencer, who's a sociology professor out of the D.C. area, and attorney Bobby Edmonds. And this show was just crazy. The numbers were crazy. The audience participation was crazy. It was just really a great show. A lot of information about Casey Anthony came out in this show. Mr. Padella, he's second to none. He was absolutely a great guest. And we just really had a great time on this show talking about all the events that occurred leading up to the acquittal, I guess, if you want to call it that, of Casey Anthony. Many people didn't believe that she would get off, but she did. But Leonard Padella told us all the things that we didn't hear in the media, all the things that happened behind the scene, in the home. He was there. He and his staff went into the home and protected the family for a short period of time during the initial investigation as to the whereabouts of Casey Anthony's little girl and Kaylee. And it was just some really interesting details that surfaced from this interview. And Mr. Padella actually, he had many different views that a lot of people found odd about, you know, how he felt after actually meeting Casey Anthony. I think he even made a comment during this show that he would actually hire her if he had the opportunity, because he felt that Casey Anthony was such a good liar that he would need somebody like that on his staff. So this show, like I said, is one of the most popular shows that we've ever done on Blog Talk Radio on Center Stage. And we really, I don't think we've ever rebroadcasted. So tonight, that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to attempt to go in and rebroadcast the show that featured Leonard Padella, Dr. Zoe Spencer, and attorney Bobby Edmonds. And we're going to be talking about, like I said, the Casey Anthony case. This was after she was acquitted, and Mr. Padella, Dr. Zoe Spencer, and attorney Bobby Edmonds came on to commentate about that particular show. So I hope you all enjoy it, because it was really a lot of fun to do. And like I said, the audience participation was great as well. And so rarely do you get to do a show where the information comes out and the audience and everybody is on the same page. And that's exactly what happened on this show. So we're going to try to cue it up, and we're going to try to play that show for you tonight. Give us 1 second to cue it. But like I said, one of the most fun shows we've ever done on Blog Talk Radio. Let's see if we can get it to come on. Besides that, listen, I'd like to get your emails. Tell us what you think of the show. Tell us what kind of shows you'd like to see us do. We're looking for new advertisers here on Blog Talk Radio. So if you'd like to advertise on Center Stage, send us an email at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. And we will get back with you at our earliest convenience, and let's see if we can make it happen. If there's things about the show you don't like, we'd like to hear that as well. We want you to tell us how you feel about the show, Center Stage, to what you like to hear talk radio do while we bring in you great guests. Are we basically bringing topics to you that, you know, inform you? That's the kind of show we want. We want to entertain and inform. So we hope that we're doing that. And if we're not, tell us. You know, we got thick skin around here, so you can tell us if you hate what we're doing, or if you if you'd like to see us change some things, we'd like to see if we can make it happen. If you have guests that you think we ought to bring on the show, tell us who they are. We would love to to bring on any guest who's bringing on information that we think is pertinent to what's going on in our country. Basically, health shows, things that can help us all be healthier. Fun stuff. You know, we like to do fun stuff, too. We don't do a lot of it, but we really would love to do things that we think you all would enjoy. Those are how we pick our topics. We pick our topics based on what we think you all would like. Okay, y'all, I'm trying to cue y'all, so give me a second. I'm rambling as I try to cue this show because I'm struggling. For whatever reason, we're having trouble to open the show, but give us a second here. But we just want to hear from you overall. We'd like to hear who's listening. You know, what part of the country are you coming from? What makes Center Stage a show that you listen to? We want to know all those kinds of things. We are nosy. A lot of times people tell us or ask us, you know, who our listening audience is. And actually, in a lot of cases, we can't really tell unless you speak to us via email and tell us what part of the country you're coming from and what makes you listen to Center Stage. So do that for me. Send me an email this week, centerstageradio@yahoo.com. Make it attention, Carrie, and just tell me what you know. Here we go. Enjoy the show, you all. I'm gonna go get some more.
thank you for coming center stage tonight. For our topic, we're talking about the Casey Anthony trial. We're going to be talking with bounty hunter Leonard Padilla, attorney and judge Bobby Edmonds, sociology professor Dr. Joe Spencer, and Oklahoma criminal attorney Anthony McKesson. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Today we're going to be talking about the trial. Do you believe that Jose Baez and his defense team won, or do you believe the prosecution failed to lay out a timeline and definitively tell us what happened to cause the death of Kaylee Anthony? Did the prosecution fail to tell us the who, the what, the when, the where, and the how of Kaylee's disappearance for 31 days? And did the Anthonys, George, Lee, and Casey Anthony all manage to turn the trial into a case of who done it and what done it, therefore confusing the jury, which resulted in Casey being found not guilty? Well, tonight we're going to play the 911 tape, as well as hopefully lay out a timeline to track what happened from the point Kaylee was first reported missing. At this time, I'm going to introduce my panel. But before I do, I want to remind you that the views and opinions of my guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage or the host. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce to you a California bounty hunter, the one who posted the $500,000 bail that first got Casey Anthony out of jail. That's Mr. Leonard Padilla. Also, we have attorney and judge Bobby Edmonds, sociology professor Dr. Zoe Spencer, and Oklahoma criminal attorney Mr. Anthony McKesson. Good evening, everyone. I'm going to open your phone line. Good evening, everyone. Good evening.
We're Leonard Padilla, California. Good evening, folks.
Nay. Do I have Mr. McKesson on the phone? I opened somebody's phone line incorrectly then. Do I have Bobby Evans on the line? Yes, on the line. Okay. Then I'm going to find Dr. Zoe Spencer. Dr. Zoe Spencer, are you on the line?
I'm here. Good evening, Carrie.
Good evening. Okay, you all. So we're going to start with Mr. Padilla. Let's tell us what you believe happened to Kaylee Anthony. What happened to little Kaylee?
Okay, on the night of the 15th of June, Casey returned home, and her mother had been at her father's rest home with the child. There was a discussion about $320-some that were missing from Cindy's mother's account that Casey had transferred to an AT&T bill in order to keep her phone hooked up. The argument got very serious enough to where the neighbors could hear the discussion and the fight that ensued, and also the fact that Cindy got so upset that she actually physically grabbed Casey around the neck and was actually choking her. Now, prior to that time, Cindy had been swimming in the pool with her daughter, granddaughter, and as Casey came home, they prepared her for bed. When the fight got so upset, Casey went to her bedroom. The mother was still very upset, and it was like Casey was going to go to bed and everything was cool. But what she did, in fact, was dress her daughter, except for shoes and socks. And as soon as Cindy was asleep, or at least Casey thought she was asleep, she snuck out of the house and got in the car. Now, she had a serious problem with Tony Lazaro, who ran the club. She could not take the child to Lazaro's residence in the evening at night. She could take her during the day as long as she was there and available to watch her, but she could not have her come there at night if Casey intended to sleep over. Therefore, on several occasions prior to this, she had learned how to make chloroform and had put the child to sleep. The reason she learned how to make chloroform is because she no longer had the ability or the financial wherewithal to buy Xanax, which was, according to what I learned back there in 2008, a common situation for putting children to sleep instead of some of the other more common things. But she was broke, had no money, no job, running out of gas constantly, and therefore had turned to chloroform. It had worked several times. There was no problem. We talked to people that were friends where she actually had the child, but parties and the child will sleep right through the parties.
Well, you have, he had to make the chloroform, right?
Excuse me?
He had to make the chloroform.
Right, which is really quite simple to make. The chloroform got banned in the United States back in the 70s because it was so dangerous and so children have a way of going around and they smell something and load it up in the nose and smell it. One good whip of chloroform in a child's sleep. When I was stationed in Arizona, we used to use it to pump into some holes outside the base to make the rattlesnakes somewhat lethargic. We didn't want to say we were killing them because then we'd have all sorts of problems, but because that kept them from crawling onto the base during the day for shade under the aircraft. But in this particular situation, she recognized that at about 2 in the morning after she had given her the chloroform, and I was getting back in the car. The child was lifeless, and she put her in the car seat. She basically felt at that time that she was dead. Didn't really know what to do, and drove around till about 4:35 in the morning. At which time, she went to Lazaro's house. This was the morning of the 16th. Parked the car at the far end of the parking lot where Lazaro lives. I went to the apartment, spent some time there. They then that evening went down some movies. She spent the night there. The next morning, she borrowed his Jeep. She didn't want to drive her car because she had the child wrapped in a blanket in the trunk of the car. She borrowed the Jeep on the morning of the 17th, went to the Sawgrass Apartments after she'd been over to see another friend of hers that morning. He was busy helping his mother. She then went to the Sawgrass Apartments where Dante. At that time, she saw Zenaida sent by her New York-plated Kia Silver. Not a Ford Focus, but a silver Kia. She mistook it as a Ford Focus because her previous boyfriend, Ricardo Morales, owned a Ford Focus, silver in color.
Okay, are we talking about Zenaida, the Zanny the Nanny?
Correct, Zanny the Nanny.
Okay.
She pays attention to the fact that this lady's got a couple kids, goes up to the office, she knows the young gentleman that handles the office during the day, says, hey, that lady, she's the lady that's looking to rent an apartment, she gets divorced, she has two children. And she actually takes down the information. The next day, she goes back to the house with her child in the front of the car, borrows the shovel from the neighbor. Her intention is to bury the child next to the dollhouse in the backyard. The dirt's too hard. She doesn't have the ability to work that hard. So then, she decides, okay, I will wrap the child in a couple plastic bags and a laundry bag, put tape on the child's mouth. When the child's body is found, it'll be a kidnapping that went wrong or whatever. Put the child back in the trunk of the car. She drives around until the 24th when her dad's looking for his gas can. The 24th, she panics. It does what is commonly referred to in the business as a panic dump. She drives down to the end of the street, makes a right-hand turn at the dead end, into the bushes, gets the child out. By this time, the Florida sun. The child is nothing but 35 pounds of what you might call liquid bones and stew. As she's pulling the body out of the trunk, the bag rips. So now you have horrible decomposition all over her and the car in the trunk. As she turns around and takes a step, she trips over some building blocks that are there, and the body just kind of falls out of her hands and rolls up against what you might call a log or a piece of tree that is laying there. All of this is within 19 feet from the exact edge of the road to where the body ended up laying. If you take the mowing strip, which is a 5-foot wide strip, and take 5-foot width of the car, that takes 10 feet to take another 5 feet to where she tripped over the block, building block, but the body was 4 foot inside the building blocks. That's where the body rested from that time, June 24th, until December the 11th, when Juan found the body.
Okay. So that's Mr. Padilla's version of what he thinks happened. Now, my question is, how did you come up with those facts? Or how do you believe that this is what happened?
A lot of the facts came from Casey's own mouth to Tracy, who lived with her for 9 days.
Okay, and Tracy was who? She was the person that was hired by you to watch her because you had posted the mail?
Yes, Tracy has worked for me for many, many, many years. Tracy's got experience in many areas of the work that we do, which is locating fugitives, locating lost people, and sometimes locating murderers before they've even been charged.
Okay.
So there's a tremendous amount of experience in her There's a tremendous amount of experience that Rob Nix, who was the deputy sheriff for the Sacramento County Sheriff's Office.
Uh-huh.
He then came to work for me almost 20 years ago and has probably 4,000 arrests to his credit.
Rob Nix was over security, correct?
He was in charge of security.
Okay. And your nephew was the actual...
My nephew, Tony Padilla, is a bail agent in California.
Okay, so he's the one that actually posted the bond.
He's the one that I said, hey, I'll pay you the $50,000 if you'll go to Florida with us and post the bond. He then contacted Al Estes, who works for the same company that he does out of Houston, Texas, and had Al Estes post the bond for him because you have to be licensed in Florida. He's the one that actually posted the bond with Casey Emmons, yes.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, now that's Mr. Padilla's facts about Warren Moore. That's what he believes happened. We're going to ask our other two guests what they believe happened, then we're going to go into the timeline, and we're going to also play the 911 tape tonight, because we're going to try to reconstruct what we think happened. We, you know, there's no way of definitively knowing, but Wikipedia had the timeline, and so did CFNews13.com. And so we're going to kind of go back and forth off the timelines that I see on both of those sites, and we're going to kind of try to figure out what we think happened, because I think what I noticed in this particular trial was, I think everybody got confused about the facts. When I say everyone, I think I'm speaking of the jury. I think they got very confused with all the different scenarios that were thrown out there, and they just said, okay, that poses reasonable doubt, so therefore we can't convict her.
Can I make a statement?
Yes, sir.
Okay, here's one of the problems. Now, let me give you a little background on me, okay?
Okay.
I'm a young guy that went to five different high schools in California, worked in the fields, Mexican families, immigrants. I went in the Air Force when I was 17. I was lucky enough to be bright enough to get picked for a special unit that went to Europe.
Uh-huh.
We worked in Libya, worked in Egypt, worked in all the countries of Europe. Uh-huh. And by the time I had come out of the military, I knew two things. I knew how to kill and I knew how to think.
Uh-huh.
Now, those are things that, you know, where do you put these items to work that you become real good at? Well, I went to law school under the GI Bill. Under the GI Bill, I went to Lincoln Law School and I got my degree in 1980. Now, 2 years after I graduated, I noticed that there was a lot of Mexican people, folks like myself, go to law school because they didn't have the money. I was lucky enough to go under GI. So in 1982, I started the University of Northern California, Lorenzo Patino Law School, later renamed for a good friend of mine, Judge Patino, who died of leukemia in 1983. So it's the Lorenzo Patino Law School. In this school are individuals that are very street savvy, very street wise. But most of them, I've had to help get GEDs in high school to get them into the paralegal program, to get them into the law school program, to get them past the college level equivalency program.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very bright, and I brag about it, very bright and very intuitive. I know how to think. A lot of people think, well, I know how to think. Everybody knows how to think. So until a fellow by the name of Lieutenant Barak took me aside in the Air Force, and basically said, I want to teach you how to think. I did not realize I didn't know how to think. But one thing I do know is how to think, and I teach all the students and all of the professors that teach at my law school. The first thing you must know about law is how to think. One of the things that happened was, Baez, who I consider to be a good friend and a stellar attorney, did not win the case. Ashton lost it. Ashton lost it because he was afraid of certain facts. He didn't want to put the fight with Cindy Anthony into evidence because he thought that would create a question mark about Cindy Anthony. He wanted to be a witness of his. He also didn't put George Anthony under the spotlight when he lied about seeing the child leave the house the very next day on the 16th. He didn't see her leave with the child on the 16th because she left the night before. That was a lie. But Cindy and George got locked in that because they didn't want to look like anything less than a stellar family. Ashton knew all of these things, but he didn't do anything about the fight, and he didn't call George about him not seeing that child the next day. He also didn't put Tracy on the stand who lived with Casey.
For 9 days, after she was released from jail the first time.
9 days, 24/7. Those two women bonded, and today, Tracy has said it a dozen times, if not more than that, except for the fact of what she did. I love that girl.
Wow.
She's like my soul sister.
And you know what? That's one thing that I noticed, that Casey obviously has a very winning personality, because I could tell, and I think I said this to Dr. Zoe Spencer, that it seemed like the defense team really fell in love with her. It seemed like they bonded with her, and they really, you know, worked hard to get her out of this. But we're going to go to attorney and judge Bobby Edmonds. Attorney Edmonds, what do you think happened? You followed the trial. What do you think happened?
I saw the trial, but there were, you definitely really couldn't connect cases. The way it was presented, there were so many connected the evidence to history. Additionally, when you look at trying to see what time period did this child actually die, and of course they tried to use scientific evidence, but that didn't speak any DNA to cases. The things that Mr. Padilla was saying, those things didn't really come out in court. And of course, even if the fight was meant to come out, it's going to further show that that was a dysfunctional family. And when the parties were testifying, it appears that they weren't as credible as they should have been, particularly their father. So you see that there, either they were covering up something or there was something within their family that they did not want to be disclosed. So they didn't make very good witnesses, I didn't think, for the prosecution. And a defense attorney only has to prove that reasonable doubt. But to the level of the jury would say, we have some serious problems here. It doesn't have to be, and it depends on the factual circumstances. So the jurors here did not include all the eyewitnesses out there because of it was in public opinion. Would have been found guilty. But I assessed the case before the jury actually rendered the verdict, and I was telling people, they're going to find her not guilty of the charges, but they will find her guilty of something less, possibly the misdemeanor. And that's what happened later on that day, because I could not see how, if the jury did look at all the evidence that was as presented, there were doubts. There was credibility issues with the father. Honey, mother gets up there and says she did some research on the computer with chloroform. You have some doubts being built. And that's really all the prosecution had to do. They didn't have to put Casey on the stand. They really didn't have to call a single witness. But they chose to call witnesses because it was necessary with this high profile case to call the witnesses at least.
Okay.
We don't even know now. How did the baby die? How did she? We know there was tape allegedly over her face. We know that chloroform was allegedly involved. I hear Mr. Padilla says that Casey had a practice, had a practice of putting the baby to sleep with the chloroform.
Sure.
Well, when did she get that pump? Did her mother do that when she was a little child? I don't know. There are so many issues with the family that a service to me. And so, at this point, I really don't know. But we know what was presented in court, and all the judge can do is rule on the issues of law, on the objection. All the defense attorney can do is use what he had, and the strategy of not calling certain witnesses. That was a strategy, good or bad.
Let me see if I can inject something here.
Okay. Yeah.
One of the problems that Ashton had, and I'm glad you've got a judge on this show, was that on about the second or the third visit that Maez had with Casey in the jail, the conversation was overheard by one of the investigators in the case. Every time that Maez went to visit Casey, the investigation team was contacted.
Oh,
I think it was the third time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was about the third time Maez, she related the drowning of the child in the pool and the dad and her making the body down around the corner, placing the body where it was found. She related that to Maez. Law enforcement heard it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, law enforcement, as the judge can tell you, had a predicament in their hands.
Yeah.
They cannot listen to the conversation, therefore, they cannot do anything other than what do we do? We know where the body is. How do we find the body? The meeting would have
been suppressed. That type of evidence would have been suppressed because they violated a right that reader where the body was so that he could go and discover the body?
Let me walk it backwards for you.
Okay.
In the latter part of August, when Tim Miller was there, on the 26th and the 27th, I think it was the 27th, the same day that something else happened, he was told by one of the investigators, the lead investigator, I've got you $5,000, don't leave town, because Tim was in, he was leaving town. He was leaving. He got in a big row with Cindy over the searching of the body. Cindy said the child's alive. He's saying she's, you know, possibly deceased. Tim was there because my nephew, Tony Padilla, close to the pond, had contacted Cindy and told her, get a hold of Tim Miller in Texas. All right, Tim's leaving town. This cop comes and says, don't leave, don't leave. I've got you $5,000 from the sheriff's special fund. Go search by the school, which is basically where the body was. Okay. Tim doesn't find the body. Subsequently, I asked Tim, why didn't you search where the body was? He says, well, it was 4 to 10 foot of water there, which it was. Hurricane Bay had come in there and made that a big pond, a huge pond.
But it's him again, it's who?
Tim Miller. He was out of Texas.
Okay.
He didn't want to lose his equipment. He made a cursory search of there, that place and other places, including Jake Blanchard, and left town. Subsequently, there was a situation that arose where, what do we do? How do we find the body without being connected to it? Well, this one gentleman said, wait a minute, Michelle Carpentier, she's in the detention side of the jail. She works in the jail. Her boyfriend is a meter reader, but he works across town. Now, look up when Roy Cronk was transferred to that area.
So the reader did not always work that particular area. He was transferred to that area.
Right.
His girlfriend worked at the jail.
Yes. Michelle Carpentier worked at the jail. Now, if you form a mental picture of the area where the body was found, when I first heard where the body was found, I remember that there was a place, but I just couldn't see why a water meter reader would be in that area. Because there isn't a single house along there. The houses are water meters, nothing. It's just a stretch of swamp.
So legitimately, he had no reason to be there.
Zero reason to be there.
Wow.
Now, on August the 11th, why is he talking about bones? You heard the 11th and the 12th and the 13th of August, those phone calls?
Yeah.
Why is he talking about bones? Skull?
So you're talking about what the meter reader said to 911.
No, he said it to his dispatch.
Okay, he said to his dispatch. Okay,
gotcha. August 11th, 12th, and 13th. Listen to those calls in detail. On the 11th of August, there was no mention by law enforcement of anything that the body. They were looking for a missing child. Period. Well, how did law enforcement then privately know they were looking for a body?
Okay. So he would have had to overhear the conversation to know that it was no longer a missing child, that it was a body.
On the 11th of August.
Wow. In a fair sense, you're indicating that there was a cover up.
Wait a minute. He talks about a pool cover. There was a pool cover, a great pool cover, a striped pool cover. Listen to the calls. That is not a pool cover. It's one of these big umbrella tents with the windows rolled up against the brush, but when you look at it from 30 foot away, it looks like something that might be a pool cover, but it's not. It's an umbrella all rolled up. It's still there. As of 2 weeks ago when I was there, it was still there.
So did Mr. Cronk collect a reward money?
I think he eventually got $15,000 for the picture of the snake, which was not a snake that he picked up. It was a snake that David Dean. There were 3 meter readers that were there that morning. Not one, 3.
Okay.
Now,
wow.
The snake was picked up by David Dean. Subsequently, there was a big thing about the snake. I set about, I figured, okay. I called David Dean, I says, where's the snake? In my freezer. I called the FBI. I told the FBI, you should check that snake. Well, why should we? I says, hey, you know, this is after the body had been found. I said, let's talk about chloroform. Maybe the snake stuck its head in the bag and got a bunch of chloroform. Who knows? So they went out to search for it and got the snake. They still have the snake in evidence.
Wow.
The thing that came up that Ashton didn't even want to get close to, one time when Baez or somebody's asking somebody, I think it was Hoover, regarding the pictures that he'd offered to somebody for sale?
Mm-hmm.
That was me. He offered a few after the body was found. On, I think, the 13th or the 14th of December, he says, hey, Leonard, you want to buy some pictures? I think, concentrated, said, kept no one part of it. Finally, he showed them to me, and I said, you better get a hold of Big Savage with the FBI. He'd be very interested in why you guys were out there on the 14th and 15th of November, exactly 72 feet away from where the body was, which is where Kronk was, exactly 72 feet away on the 11th, 12th, and 13th of August. The reason he was 72 feet away, remember when I told you she stepped out of the car? She had this stuff dripping all over her. Took two steps and tripped over some building blocks?
Right.
Well, she's telling Baez that she tripped over the building blocks. That's key. Because if you go 72 feet from where the body was found, there's a stack of building blocks there. But these are in plain sight. Right by the edge of the road, in plain sight. Not his. In the grass, like the ones she tripped over.
Wow. Yeah, we got some work to get to. We got to get to the 911 thing. We got to put this timeline together. And also, we want to hear from Dr. Joe Spencer. Dr. Joe Spencer, what do you think happened?
Carrie,
okay, I think we've got a connection problem with Dr. Joe Spencer.
Carrie, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. What do you think happened?
Okay.
What happened to Kaylee Anthony?
You know, I'm listening to Mr. Padillo, and I have to admit that I did not follow the trial as closely as other people followed it, and I really just got in on the tail end of the discussion, and I'm listening to him, and he seems to have a lot of information that was not presented. You know, I can speculate on it because, you know, we've kind of discussed, I have my own hypothesis, you know, about what happened. One of my concerns is even in listening to the 911 tape, and I know that we're going to get to that at some point, you know, it seems like everybody is regurgitating the things that were presented. Mr. Padillo seems to have some additional information, but it seems like everyone is regurgitating the chain of events that were recorded by Casey's mother and her father. And, you know, I really question whether or not those accounts are true. I really have some serious questions, and I guess I'm the naysayer. Everyone is talking about chloroform. You know, I don't see where chloroform entered the picture. Mr. Padillo made mention about that Casey had used forms of putting Kaylee to sleep before, but I don't remember anybody taking the stand to attest to that. So, you know, I really have questions about whether or not the chain of events, as reported by Cindy Anthony and her father, are actually accurate. I think it has to a lot of people. You
I think that's
one thing. We're going to play it now. And you all decide for yourself, and I'd like to discuss it, discuss the tape afterwards, because I hear a whole lot in the 911 tape, which I think is this is the voice that you'll hear is Casey Anthony and Cindy Anthony talking to a female 911 operator. And I think this really pretty much sets the stage for how the rest of the investigation went after this. Okay, here we go.
911, what's your emergency? I couldn't have opened the door just because I had all of my grandmother's hats and trinkets. She has the whistle for a market park. My mother finally admitted that she's been missed. Okay, what is her name? Okay, what is the address that you're calling from? Okay, I'm going to put her for you. I'm going to put her also. Oh, I'm going to put her for
Anthony?
Yes.
Okay, is she white, black, or Hispanic?
She's white.
Let me interject something. 31 days from that phone call is the 15th of June.
that phone call is the 16th of June when George said she walked out of the house with the baby.
Not be missing
and Cindy Anthony staying at the same time that she smelled death in the car. Is the car missing?
Okay, question. Remember on the 24th when she drove around the corner?
Yes.
Dumped the body? Okay. Now, she ripped the bag and she got the composition on herself. That's the clothes that Cindy washed. And she got the composition in the trunk of the car. That was the borrowed. Now, she's driving around in the car on the 27th, 2 days later. 3 days later, she says to her friend, Amy, oh, my dad borrowed the car, ran over some animals, and I got this terrible smell in the car. The same evening, the 27th, on a Friday night, she parks it next to the dumpster at the Amscot. Says she ran out of gas, just kind of walks away from it, okay? Just literally walks away from the car. Now, the car got towed on the 30th. Mrs. Sanchez, the manager there, called on Monday morning. She's seen that car for 3 days parked there. She called the tow yard. The tow yard comes and tows the car off. Gentleman at the tow yard testified there was the death smell in the car. But here's what happens. The notice gets sent out on the 4th of July, or the 5th of July, I believe, to the Anthony's. They don't use their front door when they come and go. They always click the garage door up, drive into the garage door, lower the door, and go in through the kitchen from the garage.
Okay,
they never see.
Says that they found that notice on the 13th.
They found it on the 15th.
Okay.
But that's only because they never used the front door to go in and out of that house. Even when we were there, they would drive in the garage, put the door down behind their vehicle, and walk in the kitchen door. Very seldom did they use the front door, which is where the notice was put, on the front door of the house. On the 15th, George is out there fluttering around in the yard. He sees this thing in the door, and he goes over there and he pulls it. And he's very upset, very aggravated, because it's not the first time he's had to go to a tow yard and recover the car. Because she's run out of gas, left it on the side of the freeway, or in a neighborhood, they've towed the car and stored it, and it cost him $300 every time. So he's very aggravated. Why does he take a gas can with him when he goes to the yard? Well, because he knows, he figures he's going to need gas. Now, does he have gas in the can at the time, or does he have to go fill the gas can? I don't know. I forgot what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But when he's there, George has been a homicide detective in Ohio for 10 years, homicide.
Mm-hmm.
He has smelled decomposing bodies.
Mm-hmm.
When he nears the car, he knows that there's decomposition there. Once you smell decomposition, you never, ever forget it. Cindy might not as well as a nurse should know decomposition, but George knows there's decomposition. What did he say? I thought it was either my daughter or my granddaughter, and I was praying that it wasn't either one. When he looks in the trunk and he sees garbage in there, his mind clicked, oh my God, thank you, Lord, it's not my daughter or my granddaughter. They take the car home, but George in the back of his mind knows there's decomposition. When the cops come to the house, the cops that walk through the garage where the car is, know there's decomposition.
Okay, remind me of what day this is.
The 16th.
Of July.
There was cops there on the 15th, and there was cops there on the 16th. 16th is when they went on the big tour. They went to the Sawgrass Apartments. They went to where the Gloria, the mother of this babysitter, was supposed to be. They went out to the studios.
Universal.
And finally, they got tired of chasing their tail. They arrested her. Now, the cops were sitting there saying there's decomposition. I mean, there's no way the cops are thinking the child's alive, but there's decomposition in front of the car. They, in their own mind, have got a woman that is lying to them about where their daughter is, and there's decomposition smells. You know, the child's dead. She was in the trunk of the car. They're not going to jump up and say this. They've got a messy case on their hands already, because this young lady is an accomplished liar. When I met her, the very next day after I met her, we were sitting on the couch. We were sitting there talking, just talking about general things. And I realized that she was lying about things she didn't have to lie about. And I told her, Casey, when you get through this, and you will get through it, you are going to get through it. You come see me, and I'll give you a job in the work I do, because I need accomplished liars. Did she get up? Did she get upset up here? No, she just giggled and looked at me. She says, for real? I said, yes.
Yeah. Okay, y'all, we gotta play catch up. I'm gonna go to the meter reader's dispatch call about the body of Kaylee Anthony. We also want to deal with the timeline, and we got a couple phone calls we gotta get to y'all. But before I do that, if you just can see it, you'll keep something or stage tonight. We're talking about the Katie Anthony case. We're talking to Bailey Hunt and Leonard Padilla, Fort Worth attorney and judge Bobby Edmonds, and sociology professor Dr. Zoe Fisher. If you're the phone lines and have a question or comment, press 1. Or if you're listening in via the internet, dial us up at 347-850-8390. And again, press 1. A reminder, the chat room is open tonight. So if you have a question or a comment, you can post it in the chat room. If you would, put it in red so I can see it quickly when I glance into the chat room throughout the night. Also, tonight's session of Center Stage is being brought to you by African American News and Commentary Blog, your single source for news, events, and commentary that is of unique interest to African Americans. They're located on the web at www.africanamericannewsandcommentary.com. Tonight's segment of Center Stage is also being brought to you by Daily Deposits for the Soul, your daily guide to enriching your soul and improving your mind in just 15 minutes a day. They're located on the web at www.dailydeposithsforthesoul.com. Okay, y'all, let's go to this this dispatch call or this meter reader's call to his dispatch about what happened with him finding this bag
that he thinks is the power.
Kind of stops, and then there's like this. Indicate
indicated that they may have been eavesdropping during conversations of Kaylee while she was in jail.
Investigators and their laws
and they pursue this capital case against this girl, then the prosecutors would have violated their oath of office. If that comes out that they are intentionally trying to get a capital case against her and their own investigation, and so it's a cover-up that could have been charged fraud against them, but that's not the case here.
Why isn't it the case?
Well, because, Mr. Padilla, you know that, but the judge didn't know it, the jury didn't know it, it didn't come out in testimony.
Right, because they started the case. Remember the first?
It didn't come out that the prosecutors knew that their law enforcement officers did this in fact happened. If they knew that their law enforcement officers eavesdropped or violated their constitutional right to privacy or the conversations between attorney client and a jail facility, and then I guess statured away to discover that body on acquired information, then you will have a big scandal surrounding
that. Yes, remember where Ashton started the trial? With the call, not from Kronk on the 11th, 12th, and 13th, not from Kronk on the 11th of December, but with dispatch calling 911. The water meter reader's dispatch calling 911 is where Ashton started the trial. He didn't start with any one of the seven people that were living with Casey that Casey spoke to very openly, consistently, every day on a daily basis. He didn't start with the calls from Kronk on the 11th, 12th, and 13th, or even Kronk's call in December. He was very deceptive in starting the trial with the call from the dispatcher of the water people to 911. Therefore, staying away from anything that led up to the discovery of the body.
Okay, now you want to say something if you want to say something? I am about to burst. It's very clear that the dispatcher knew where the body was and knew that there was a body in it, in the brush or whatever. I mean, there are two things. There's an involved reaction, an attached reaction, and then there's a detached reaction. He calls three times, and it's very, very clear that he is trying to herd law enforcement to this area. And then he even makes reference and alludes to, well, what if there's a body? And he also states numerous times, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is, but it just doesn't look right to me. So it's very clear that he knows that there's a body. And I don't know if I heard it correctly in the beginning, if he mentioned Anthony or not, but I thought in the first take he actually started out the conversation by mentioning the case or something. I don't know if I misheard that. But I said that he mentioned that address in the area, that their home is along that street or near the area. And it's right. So I definitely think that he knew, and I do agree with Mr. Padillo that someone had to have given him that information. However, Mr. Padillo, and I don't want to, you know, make it a thing, because I have my own hypothesis about, you know, the circumstances, and you know, nobody wants to hear it. But ultimately, he said that only Casey, her attorney, and the crew knew what happened to Casey. I disagree with that. I really think that her parents were definitely involved in the 911 call case between her mom and Casey. You can hear her mother coaching her in the background. And there's something that we call detached affect in psychosocial terms. And that's when somebody removes themselves from her situation. And Casey is very, very detached in that phone call. However, she is very attached to the 31 days, which I believe, based on that, was the day her daughter died. I definitely disagree that chloroform had anything to do with it. I think all of that has been disproven. You know, the 84 calls turned into, or the 84 searches turned into one search, which could have been detrimental to her. And I agree with the judge. I was there too, you know, sideline coaching. And I knew that there was no way possible that the jury, based on the evidence, could have legitimately found her guilty. So, you know, what Mr. Padillo is saying, I respect it. I think that he has some, you know, some
and also even in the 911 call, it seems to me that she's almost like a bystander to the way that her daughter's death is going to be managed. So I really more so believe that her death was an accident and it was a cover-up. Something happened, and when the cover-up unraveled, they rolled their daughter under the bus. That's what I believe.
Wow. Okay, y'all, we're going to go back to the phone lines, area code 512. And 415, I'm not sure if you were finished with your question. I'll come back to you. Area code 512, 739. Good evening, you're on center stage.
Hi. Hi. I just wanted to call in just a couple things. First of all, I need to talk to this grandparent from the doctor. Gary, Gary's here, and I also host the Blog Talk Radio show. Good job, Gary. You're doing awesome, and I'm really glad you got this topic going. And I'm even more pleased that if you have a doctor that, you know, takes a commitment, and it sounds like you've done a little bit of research, too. And I've done an extreme analysis of research.
This particular case?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, tell us what you know.
Well, I can't really just lay out what I know because I have 2 months worth of experience in
Okay.
So, you could pick any topic and I'll tell you what I know. But one thing I would like to comment on, and first of all, I don't have to be a doctor, but all of them be on my show as well. So that up is my hometown. But anyway, I feel that going down to what the fault.
Send me an email, and I'll look you up with the doctor. But go ahead, you were saying what else?
Yeah, okay, cool. I was saying, you know, it's very clear, very obvious that George Anthony was involved. And from our viewpoint, and you know, like I said, I still get this a lot, so I have a lot of, I don't want to say evidence, but I will say facts to show that Casey was indeed at the house on the morning of the if you look at the two maps.
Okay, was that 15th of June, 15th of July, 15th of what?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so when I put it together, the only thing that makes out to the we can go ahead and set aside how he died. Listen here. Because although it's relevant in terms of understanding his involvement. And just pick it up just a little bit after she died. So let's just say that on the 15th, they were there and somehow they died. And I don't know if it was an accident. I don't know if it was murder because that has not, absolutely has not been certain. Sorry. So we do know she died. We know that the 16th was the 15th left. So the 12th. So let's say she died that morning, somewhere in around 4-2, because that is a gap. And any time that that's dead ball, whether it's laptop, desktop, phone, texting, whatever, and it's very unusual to hear this case.
married and divorced, and mother says I can take over the payments on the house. Now, she doesn't even have a job. She's telling Amy that she's not taking over the payments on the house. Remember when Judge Perry said something to the effect he quipped? Hey, she probably was thinking of killing her parents?
Mm.
He couldn't have been closer to the truth. Casey was going to kill her parents and end up with the house.
Mm.
In Casey's own mind, the way she operates, the way she thinks, that was a natural scheme. She killed her parents. All she has to do is step in and take over the payments. In order to take over the payments, she then needs a roommate that will help make some of the rent payment, make it a house payment.
That is crazy. Because
I can't hear myself. Set it on the bench.
But I was listening to this and looking at the family. We usually think of mental illness as typical. I think that there should have been treatment for mental illness probably for each of those family members. Casey has been trained, has never been treated, or if she has, the parents have denied in denial. And so all of this stems from there's a great issue of mental illness among all of them in their family, and particularly even the brother who addressed the fact that when his little sister was pregnant, he felt like he was abandoned by his parents because they were giving her paying attention to her. But the mental illness that Casey has gone through demonstrates her actions as an adult. And if she doesn't feel the empathy and sincereness and when death and act like a normal person, that's because in our household she's been treated like that, and they have been taught to suppress those feelings. And I don't know, the doctor probably won't have the proper term for it, but you can see that. I can see that.
And
now what she's going to have to deal with has been acquitted. So we have the stress and the pressures of the media, the negativity, the lot of dislike. Is she going to be able to have enough self-confidence, enough self-esteem to overcome this? Or is she going into a great depressive mode and doing something that's bad to herself?
Let me
I'm going to give interviews. I don't think she's giving interviews that's going to highlight some of the things that you said, Mr. Fabiola, because that she is not going to be telling the truth.
She's not.
Can I interject, though? I'm sorry, Mr. Fadil, I just got to get this in. I don't even know the young lady, but, you know, I don't know why I have a level of empathy for her, because, you know, I'm with bias, and I really do not believe that she murdered her child.
In her mind, she did. It was an accident.
No, I'm saying to you, Mr. Padillo, that I do not believe that Casey Anthony murdered her daughter, period. I do not believe that happened. I strongly believe, even based on, you know, and the judges is more of this than me. I'm an analyst, but I'm not an attorney. I believe that, like in many cases, there was a rush to put the pieces of Kaylee's death together because nobody was going to tell the truth. I believe that it was an accident. I believe that she drowned in the pool. And even what you said about the home, that solidifies it for me. Because everything that you said about how meticulous they keep things and where they came from, you're talking about developing an image that you need to protect. And when you develop that image, so much so that you're in denial about your daughter's pregnancy, or you're in denial about a divorce, or you're in denial about your family dysfunction, and you don't want to see, or you're in denial about your daughter's failure to complete high school, an accident happens. That type of dynamic is just the dynamic that you need to facilitate, making something up instead of following the normal course of action to call 911 and say there's been an accident in our house. Our granddaughter has drowned in our pool, because you don't want to deal with that stigma. And so I strongly believe that the accident happened, and I believe that George and Cindy got together and they concocted this story and they forced Casey to take on this role of perpetuating her daughter being missing. And in the 911 call, you can tell that she is very, very detached from that call. She's very, very detached from what's going on. She has her mother in the background coaching her, but she's very detached about everything except for that 31 days that she knows was the day of her daughter's death. Stuff happened. Hurricanes happened. The story began to unfold. George and Cindy had made it up. They got scared that everything was going to be opened up. And instead of coming clean, they decided that they were going to scapegoat their own daughter. And that's the Bible social term, scapegoat their own daughter in order to protect their own image. And when she lawyered up, they knew that she was not going to take the stand. She was not going to be able to tell the truth and say what happened, because it would not only implicate her parents, but it would implicate her further as well. And so they broke her under the bus. And, you know, she may be a liar. I definitely think she has issues. But, you know, I think as humans, kind of, we got to start looking at the reality that just because you have mental health issues and you've been brought up in a dysfunctional family doesn't mean that you're automatically predisposed to being a murderer, especially of your own child.
Okay, speaking of dysfunction, was she molested, Mr. Padilla? Was she molested by her father and her brother, and she, as the defense attorney, Mr. Bias, said?
In my opinion, George did not molest her ever. Did her brother touch her in a brother-sister doctor scene? I don't know. I never went into that. The first time I heard about both of those things was basically a pre-trial when there were statements that she had made to other people in the jail. And me and knowing George and meeting George, he was a cop. Now, one of the things that a lot of people look at is the fact as to when he was on the stand. You have to understand that law enforcement officers were people off the street that were looking for a job when they became cops. They're not super intelligent. They're not super anything. They just happen to have a badge and a gun. They do not like to be quizzed. They're the ones that do the asking of questions. They don't like to have questions asked. They're the ones that do the prodding of a fugitive. They're the ones that do the prodding of a suspect. They do not like to be put on the stand. George's testimony was always suspect when we used to talk to him. And we used to say, George, quit being a cop today. Come on. Just be a dad. Be a grandpa. Talk to us like a grandpa. Tell us what you used to do on a daily basis with your granddaughter. Then we'd go out to the neighborhood and check. Tell us, George, how did you feel? How did you feel when it was announced that a body had been found? Talk to us, George, about the real things in life. Don't talk to me like a cop. I've been around a million cops. I don't want to hear your answers as a cop. I want to hear them as a grandfather. I want to hear them as a father.
Can he do it?
Yes.
Tell me about the tattoo. There was a tattoo that she got, it appears like on...
July 4th.
What was the tattoo about? If she didn't do this, if it was a situation in which, you know, it was an accident...
She showed the tattoo to Casey about the second day that we were there with her.
You may show this to Tracy.
To Tracy. Casey showed it to Tracy. She said, I got this. Now watch this. I got this in memory of my daughter.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Okay. I listen, and I'll probably tell you that one.
real quickly, Leo, we're under 30 minutes left in this show. Leo, I have a question.
Are you writing the book, or are you going to be paid for your version of what happened?
Listen, I've been involved in hundreds of cases like this. And one thing I've learned, if the child is found alive or if the person is found alive, oh yeah, I'll talk about it and I'll read about it and I will take fees. But when the person is dead or the child is dead, I will not accept anything. The only thing I've accepted in this particular situation for myself or any of the people is we've accepted a couple of flights money. We definitely did not want to go to New York. Did not want to go, and they said, well, we pay for your flight. And it wasn't even the payment of the flight. It was Judge Gina Piero that I really, really, I mean, if she asked me to do something, yeah, I'll do it, you know.
But you're talking about interviews about the case.
Yeah, exactly. In other words, for the judge, I'll do it. When she asked if I'd go out for Orlando on a Wednesday morning, I flew to Orlando. I had to be in Los Angeles that afternoon. I flew to Los Angeles. I had to be in Sacramento that evening. The damn near killed me. And for her, yes, I will walk on water.
Attorney and Judge Bobby Edmonds and Sociology Professor Dr. Joe Spencer. Okay, y'all, let's start with you.
shot by Cindy Anthony. Supposedly she had taken her to her father's retirement home to see the father. It appears on June 21st, Casey Anthony made an entry into her diary in which she said, I haven't been this happy. And it appears that on June 30th, Casey's car was towed and was taken to the tow yard. And then it seems like on July 2nd, and I'll try to move quickly through this, that's when she got the tattoo, the Bella Vita tattoos that, you know, like I said, an Italian saying that means beautiful wife. Then it appears on July 12, 2008, is when George and Cindy said they confronted Casey about why they had seen Kaylee for some time. July 15th is when the car was picked up by George Anthony. That's also the day that they reported Kaylee missing. When we listened to the 911 tape, we heard they initially called and said the car is missing, and it's just kind of, you know, off the cuff said, hey, and by the way, you know, my granddaughter's missing too. There's a smell in the car that looks like somebody died in it. Okay, and then on the 17th of July 2008 is when Casey Anthony was arrested. Police, you know, they said had taken her to the studios where she said she worked. They taken a tour with her and said, take us to your office. And she kind of took them around in a circle for a while before she said, hey, by the way, I don't work here anymore. I used to work here a long time ago. So then they charged her with child neglect, lying to an investigator and interfering with a criminal investigation. And she was denied bond at that time. The 21st of July, that's when posted a reward of $150,000 if someone found Kaylee Anthony alive. August 5th is when formal charges were filed against Kaylee Anthony. August 8th, Casey refused to see her brother. So what's going on at this point, Mr. Vanilla? And we want you to come back as soon as I give the timeline. August 8th, she starts not wanting to have contact with her family. She refused contact with her brother on August 8th. On August 10th, she refused to see her parents. Now this is August 10th. August 8th, she's refusing contact with her family. August 12th is when George said that he believed Kaylee had been kidnapped, and kidnappers were being watched. Why did he tell that lie, Mr. Padilla? We're going to want to address that. August 17th is when you, Mr. Padilla, arrived in Orlando, Florida. So maybe you can pick up from there what happened. But you arrived, all these things have occurred. What is the mood? What is the atmosphere of Orlando, Florida when you hit the ground?
Well, when we hit the ground, there were six of us. There was only three of us. Actually, two of us that stood out for the crowd, for the media, Tracy, Tony, Toby, Miguel, and Huizinga.
Okay, let's go back over. Tracy is the person who stayed with Casey for 9 days.
She was room with her for the 9 days, yeah, 24/7.
When she was boarded out of jail.
Tony Padilla was the mailing who got her out. She went there. They skirted off to the side. The other three individuals that were with us also skirted off to the other side, leaving me and Rob to deal with the media.
Okay.
That night, we then went to the Anthony home. They were having a vigil. We met Lee. I asked Lee, I introduced myself, having previously talked to Baez half a dozen times on the phone, to get the approval of the family to bail her out, and to get her approval to bail out, to find out if the family had it okay, put her in a safe house. They said, no, they want her to come home. Okay. So we go, we talk to the family. We have a meeting that night for about 4 hours, from about 10 p.m. to 2 a.m.
Let me jump in. You think when you hit the ground, you're looking for a missing child?
Okay.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yes, that's what Baez has basically said. And that night, we meet with them, and they say Jesse Grunt, who was in love with their daughter, who had lived with the daughter, who knew the baby, who at first thought it was his baby, took a paternity test, turned out it wasn't his baby, but he didn't care. He loved that child. The next day, we go to Baez's office. He reinforces that with a birthday card saying, I love you, two women in my life, the child, the mother. So we're like, okay, this guy probably took the kid and hit her somewhere.
This is
Baez,
the attorney?
The attorney, Baez. Yes, he has influenced us to think that Jesse Grunt had something to do with kidnapping the child.
Okay.
Now, we're not focusing on a nanny, the kidnapper type thing.
So you never believe that?
We're focusing on Jesse Grunt the next day after we're in town.
So the meter reader has already called in to the police that he's seen something, and you all think he's a suspect?
We don't even know about the meter reader at that time. We've not even heard about the meter reader.
Okay, go ahead. Okay, Jesse, hold on. I'm thinking you're meeting Mr. Cross. You're not talking about the, I'm thinking you're talking about Roy Cross.
No, Jesse Grund is the old boyfriend.
Gotcha, okay, I'm sorry. Okay.
Who used to be a cop.
Okay.
Anyhow, so we're talking about Jesse Grund. Immediately I sent my people out into the neighborhood. I want you to talk to everybody, every resident. I want to know what George's attitude was with his granddaughter. 50 people came back with, oh, yeah, I saw him. He was always pulling her in a little red wagon around the neighborhood, just, you know, walking around. She had a little red wagon. She's pulling her in the red wagon. How does he get along with his wife? You know, I've heard stories. He had an affair. She had an affair. She ran him off. Finally, they got back together after they both settled down on their tit-for-tat affairs. What about the daughter? The daughter's in and out. She supposedly works at Universal or somewhere. We don't know. She's always gone. She's always back. What about Lee? Well, Lee moved out a while back. He now lives with a girlfriend. He's not here anymore. He works for some outfit that rents parking lots for big sporting affairs.
Let me jump in right here. One thing that stands out to me, when you hit the ground, it's 2 months later. The first day of the 911 call, they said that the body, the car smelled like someone had been decomposing in the car. So why is it that you all hit the ground looking for a missing person when in fact the first 911?
One of the first things we asked George and his wife, and they both said, no, there was rotting pizza in there. Et cetera, et cetera. And we had confirmed that on one of the nights there was 3 calls to pizza parties. And we'd already looked at the pictures of the stuff that was in the trunk of the car, and yeah, there was a ton of garbage in there. My assumption at the time was, okay, George knows the difference between decomposition and rotting garbage. Now, I had not heard his statement regarding him saying that there was decomposition in the trunk. The only thing I'd heard at that point was him telling me, oh, no, I was on a safe cop. I know the difference. It was rotting garbage. Cindy, I'm a nurse. I know the difference. It was rotting garbage. Okay, fair enough. We're okay there, so. A couple of days we spent with Baez. He's telling us Jesse Grund's a prime suspect. The family's telling us. We finally get a hold of Jesse Grund, his dad. Now we're perplexed because this guy didn't kidnap anybody. He loved that child. You couldn't talk to him about that child. He broke down crying. Is he a big fake? Has he really got us suckered in? No.
Okay, Jesse Grund is the boyfriend. One thing that no one ever established during this whole trial, and y'all, this is the number one question that has always been on my mind. Where is the baby daddy?
Nobody knows. Not even she knows.
Oh, y'all. Oh,
she don't even know.
So nowhere in this whole thing did anybody establish who the baby daddy was?
Nope. She don't know. She threw out to us 10 different guys, 10 different possibilities.
Wow.
But she never once said who the baby was. 10 different possibilities she threw at us. I'll tell you why. Because there was times when she was capable of having sex 3 times a day with 3 different guys and never thinking about it. It was just in her nature and wanted adulation so bad that, hey, here I am. Come get me.
So no one ever came forward during this whole trial and said, that could have been my child.
No, well, I've had a lot of calls from people saying, I think my son was the father, I think my grandson was the father, but nobody, and I've suggested, hey, go take a DNA test. The cops have DNA from the family, they can match it up. To this day, nobody has come forward and said, here it is, proof positive.
Jerry, I want to jump in real quick because promiscuity is one of the one of the indicators of sexual abuse. So when you ask, was she molested by her father? I mean, it's not the end all to be all, but promiscuity is one of the principal indicators of being abused as a child. So I do want to point that out, and that's not my opinion.
I'm totally aware of that.
Well, Mr. Terry, real quick, can I offer my own timeline?
Yeah, go ahead.
Why not?
This is my opinion. This is my chain of events. June the 15th, I believe Casey drowned. I believe that they wrapped her body and buried her body in the backyard.
I couldn't have happened.
Let me finish first, because I'm going to run down real quick.
just a counter-argument, just a counter-argument. Okay. I believe that they buried her in the backyard. I believe that the weather conditions forced her body up. They're then in a position where they have to take her body that's now undergone some level of decomposition, and they have to move her body from their backyard. So they wrap her up in whatever, and they duct tape whatever they wrap her up in, and they take her body to the location where her body was found.
Leave my chihuahua behind to listen to this BS. I
basically had elected to become the bad guy in the act.
Okay, let me ask you, why is it that she was never engaged in the search? Is it because she was on electronic monitoring system so she couldn't leave the house?
Nope. Like Tracy says, why go search for somebody if you know they're dead?
Okay, never said, I want to go search for Kaylee.
Never once.
Wow.
Never mentioned her name except a couple times when they were looking at a scrapbook one time of Kaylee. And she says, Tracy, look at my scrapbook. I'm just as pretty as she was.
Wow. And was that raising any red flags for you all as you're sitting and listening to these things and watching the atmosphere in this particular house? Well, was it like clear to y'all, okay, we made this trip down here thinking we're looking for a missing person when actually we're looking for a dead body?
Ma'am, when I make a mistake, usually a pretty good size one. And at the time on the 27th when they announced the composition, I sat there for a good hour, and Rob Dick says to me, have you come up with an exit strategy? And for 2 days, I'm like, what do I do?
Now, was the exit strategy for the media, or was the exit strategy for the family and the defense attorney? What was the exit strategy for? I would have just found it here.
How do we extract from this situation and admit we screwed up?
Okay.
We jumped the gun. We should have waited.
Wow. So, and I understand you're possibly going to Casey Anthony down the road. But what am I understanding that's happening with you and Baez? Is Baez saying that, well, we didn't tell Padilla to get involved, Padilla kind of came down on his own, he and Edward Search, or what is he trying to say exactly?
Baez is saying that we basically, I contacted him. And I said, hey, guy, I understand. And I did this because I had discussed it with some media people up in New York, and they were following the case. And it's people that I've dealt with now on other cases, other missing children cases. I would say that half the cases we get involved in about missing children, law enforcement announces the child's probably dead, and half of them we found the child alive, the other half, they were right. But anyhow, I discussed it with him half a dozen times. He's on his way to New York. He called me from New York. I'm saying, okay, check with the family. The family's got no money. Don't worry about it. I'll pay the fee. Then it's like, okay, fine. Come on back here. Do your thing. We get back there. We do our thing. Now, by this time, Baez knows the child is dead. Regardless of how the child got there, he knows because she has laid the story on him about the drowning in the pool, which I want to tell somebody here that came up with that. That was our original thought. She drowned in the pool and the family was covering.
The day after
the decomposition thing came up, we figured, wow, there it is. Problem. The law enforcement people originally took filters out of the pool. And a lot of, in other words, they took a lot of this stuff to test. One of the things I asked the FBI, did you test the water in the pool? Decomposition starts within 4 minutes of death. Had the body been in the pool any amount of time, decomposition would have shown up in the water unless they had drained the water in the meantime. The answer to me by the FBI guy was, yeah, we tested the water and no decomposition. We thought maybe even so far as to she accidentally killed the child, put her in the pool, make it look like a drowning. It didn't work. She laid her on the grass. That's why the dog got the kids on the grass.
Yeah, but there's a level. No. In the big pool, there's a level of decomposition that has to occur in order for it to be measurable. And 4 minutes does not admit the level of decomposition that they would be able to adequately measure in a large pool. I mean, that would have to take time. So if they found her body within an hour. Okay. And then also I wanted to ask you, Mr. Padillo, you know, everybody is like George. George is the hero, or, you know, he's the victim. But then you're still talking about 31 days. What grandfather loves their grandchild so much? I mean, you haven't seen them in the 31 days, and you don't even think to make a phone call to your police buddies that, you know, would help you to look for your daughter and your granddaughter. You know, we have to also understand, where are the 911 calls from Casey Anthony's family during the 31 days that they proclaimed that she was missing?
Here's the thing. George and Cindy were having so many problems between themselves. He was having problems with his new job. She was having problems with his affair. He was having problems with her tit-for-tat affair. They were having these, every time that they asked her, and if you go back and you can fill in all 31 days, she's with the babysitter at the beach. She's down in Tampa because the babysitter had a car wreck, and I had to go down there because she was in the hospital. oh, and she went to an outing. You go back and you just concentrate on the stories that she told law enforcement, that she told her parents, and the parents related to law enforcement. It fills in all 31 days she had stories of where that child was. The parents were so embroiled in their own mess, their own life falling apart, that whatever she gave them as an excuse, they were willing to readily accept. Now, around the 4th of July...
Wait a minute, but that's assuming that the story that she gave to the police to support the story that the parents came up with was actually what she told her parents, because that doesn't mean just because she gave that as an account to the police does not mean that that's what she was actually telling her parents.
Well, if you go back and look at some of the things
where is the concrete evidence that shows that she was actually away from the home for those 31 days?
Okay, y'all, listen, we got 97 left. Wow.
Her cell phone. Things on the cell phone.
Her cell phone individuals around her within that 31 day.
Every phone call she made and every tower had bounced off them.
Okay, y'all, we got to get out here. Listen, Same center stage with us tonight as we talk about this Casey Anthony file with bounty hunter Leonard Padilla, attorney and judge Bobby S. Sociology professor, Dr. Zoe Spencer. I thank you all for being my guest tonight. I really enjoyed the discussion. Reminder, the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage or the host. I'm hoping that this conversation tonight maybe opened the eyes of somebody who was cool with us to what happened. Maybe we gave you a timeline. Maybe we let you hear a 911 tape or something that maybe helped give you some closure on this particular case. Again, thank you to my guests. Thank you so much for listening. Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Good night.